This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
When you state an opinion that goes against what the establishment thinks and what money thinks, then people are going to ridicule you. Because the whole idea of having a unique idea is that in the millions of years humans have existed, no one has ever had that idea before. And people say there's a cliche, you know, no idea is truly unique. That is just simply not true. There are some ideas that are very unique. I bring all this up because Dr. Stephen Gundry, who's a former cardiologist, really a very good cardiologist, but then he saw how much BS was in really not the medical industry, but the health industry. He's done a lot of work and a lot of research on good nutritional habits, what are good foods to eat and why, and not only for dieting, but for living longer, for having more energy. How do you live a high quality of life? Food is energy. That's the purpose for food. It's not so that we can have something to eat while we watch Netflix. It's completely 100% for energy. And consequently, Dr. Gundry, who's come on before with the plant paradox, stating that not all plants are necessarily good for you. This book is called The Energy Paradox and How to Eat to Maximize Your Energy. I think that's an extremely important topic to get across. Without further ado, Dr. Stephen Gundry. Dr. Stephen Gundry, welcome back to the podcast. Previously, you were on for your recent book, The Plant Paradox. Now it's for The Energy Paradox. We'll talk about that in a second. Just want to remind people that The Plant Paradox was about a very, your very unique take based on the research of your clients and your own research studies and so on about avoiding foods that contain what you call lectins. And it was very, it was eye-opening. It was like, I didn't realize that, of course, a lot of people eat, and I eat occasionally, you know, plant-based foods, and I have at least one kid of five who's all plant-based, and I never thought of it that plants need to avoid predators just like we do. So they emit this sort of poison called lectins, and it makes sense that that would also cause inflammation when humans eat it, and you trace a lot of your research studies back to the lectins that you talk about in the plant paradox. But now we're on the energy paradox. A lot of people, including myself, occasionally feel by midday lethargic, tired, fatigued. And it's sort of like random when am I going to get energy, when I'm not going to get it. And the energy paradox is about this. You say that we should all have great energy, that it's not really a function of necessarily our age, which I thought it was. You've been a doctor forever. You got your medical degree in 1977, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's true. And, forever.
You've done heart transplants, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. My partner and I, Dr. Leonard Bailey, invented infant and pediatric heart transplantation.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
And then we'll get to the energy paradox. So basically, you have a baby in front of you, okay? Presumably, it's not moving because it's got anesthetics. Which I imagine must to give an anesthetic to a baby must be a complicated job all by itself because you don't want to kill the baby, but you don't want the baby to be conscious during the surgery. So that must be hard.
True.
And then you slice open the chest and you know obviously where to slice. What happens? You take out the heart and put in a new heart? Like what happens?
Well, we have to put that baby on a heart-lung machine and take over the work of the heart and lungs and oxygenate the blood. So first we have to put tubes in, and then you're right, we actually take that heart out, cut it out, and then we've gone around the country to find, you know, another heart. And this heart is about the size of a walnut, just so people can visualize that. And then we have to stitch all the blood vessels back in and, you know, hope for the best that once we release everything, that this heart starts up and takes over and knock on wood.
And so it does. You have to stitch all the blood vessels back in. First off, everything you just said was like magic. And that's the whole Arthur C. Clarke quote that in the future, what seems like magic today will just be technology. I'm paraphrasing. But first off, there's machines that perform the function of the heart. And I guess right. I sort of knew that, but I didn't really know that. That seems amazing into itself too, as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, and believe it or not, these machines were first utilized, invented in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And they were pretty crude, and there were a lot of problems with them. And, you know, technology, you know, obviously keeps getting better and better. And I was actually the father of the modern way to protect the heart during heart surgery. And more heart operations are done using my catheter, the Gundry retrograde cardioplegia cannula, than any other system in the world.
So. How does that work? So is the idea that it kind of takes, I mean, what does it do? Does it like pump, how does it pump the blood?
Well, believe it or not, my system, normally when we're just plain old working on a heart, we have to cut off the blood supply to the heart to make it stop and work on it or work inside of it. And we would normally give it a cocktail of ingredients to keep it happy during that time. And I invented a way of pumping this cocktail down the veins of the heart rather than the arteries of the heart, which it's kind of like giving the heart an enema, if you get the idea. And it actually worked much better than pumping it down the arteries of the heart.
But when you remove the heart, how does the machine, how did they figure out how to keep a body going with just a heart machine?
Well, it was, I mean, it's just, it's magical in a way. They had to develop a way to have oxygen go through a membrane into blood that was flowing by in another tube and have CO2 pass through the membrane out. And now it's just, you know, ho-hum, we put some tubes in, turn on the machine, and it's magic, like you say.
That's amazing. And this is just a random question, but I was having this discussion the other day. I feel if I went back in time 1,000 years, I would be completely useless. We all think we're so smart because we're all so modern, and I would not be able to, like, make a light bulb, make a fire. I would not be able to make furniture. I wouldn't be able to do anything that we suppose, I couldn't make a computer. What do you think you would be able to do? Like, what would be your function that would show people, oh, we really need to not kill this guy? What would you take from the future if you went 1,000 years back in time?
Hey, maybe I'd be a barber surgeon. And, you know, I'd do some bloodletting and, you know, I'd get rid of humors. And I'd probably still have a job way back then.
Yeah, because I feel like with a doctor, one thing you could do that's pretty simple is you could introduce people to germ theory. They didn't really know that germs kill people.
Right. It wasn't until, you know, Pasteur and Beauchamp actually proved that germs happened.
But is there anything like amazing medical things that you would, like, would you be able to save lives that would die back then?
Oh, yeah. If I, you know, if I just went back with my tools right now, I could do some pretty impressive things. They'd probably make me, you know, King Medicine Man.
Yeah, you'd be like Merlin. If you went to King Arthur's court, like what would you be able to do? What amazing thing would you be able to do that they would be just shocked by?
Well, you know, the good news is we could, you know, get somebody really drunk with liquor so that he really wouldn't feel anything. And we could take out their gallbladder. We could fix their hernia. We could sew, you know, a limb back on that had been sliced off during jousting. And that'd be pretty miraculous.
Yeah. So I guess surgeons, as opposed to computer people, surgeons actually can do things that are real. And anyway, this has just been kind of like a pet peeve of mine, is that I'm useless in general outside of my safe little habitats.
Nobody's useless.
Well, I'm useful because I get to spread the message of people like yourself. So that's, but oh, I can't do a podcast back 1,000 years ago. But maybe I will be able to help people have more energy after this interview and after reading your book, certainly. So let's talk about that. And a lot of what you say resonates with common sense that, of course, food gives us energy. That's the whole point of food. Many people, we've become detached from that message by eating potato chips and things like that. But let's start from the beginning. What made you do this book and what was your results?
Well, I actually didn't plan to write this book. It wasn't part of, you know, my what I was going to write about. But last year, I was driving into Orange County, south of L.A., to do a thing for a PBS station. And I got a call that this person who was going to interview me wasn't going to make it in that day because she just didn't have it in her. Her energy levels were so low, she didn't have it in her to come into work.
Do you think that was real, or do you think it was just an excuse not to go to work?
No. I think it was very real. And 50% of my patient population, when I first see them, complain of, there's a code called fatigue and malaise. And 50% of the people that I see for other reasons also have fatigue. And so the fact that this millennial just didn't have it in her to come in for the interview really stuck with me. And I'm going, wow, this is more widespread than even I thought. And it turns out that I started writing this pre-COVID. And even then, 60% of people in surveys say they're either tired or have fatigue or have low energy. And in other interviews, I would say almost everybody now, thanks to COVID, is sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, the subtitle of the book is What to Do When Your Get Up and Go Is Got Up and Gone. You know, to address what you were saying, so many of us assume that our modern lifestyle, however we want to define that, pre or post or during COVID, is so stressful, is so demanding that it's normal to be tired, or normal, like you say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you gotta have a double espresso or an energy bar to get you through the rest of the day. And, you know, I travel all over the world studying long-lived societies. And many of these, particularly primitive societies, don't have words for being tired or exhausted. I followed sheep herders who were 90 years old up a hill, and it's hard to keep up with these guys. And the idea that, you know, let's take a break doesn't even resonate with these people.
They're 90 years old, they're sheep herders, and they're going up a hill. What do you say is their real age in our terms?
Oh, yeah. I mean, these guys act like they'd be, you know, 40 years of age. I mean, for instance, as I talk about, I'm soon going to turn 71. I have far more.
You look great for 71, I have to say.
I have far more energy than when I was 46. I really do. And why? Well, it's really all a part of the book. I've figured out where energy has actually come from. And one of the really fascinating things that I've mentioned before, but really resonates. So there's a study that was done out of Duke University a few years ago. And there's this primitive hunter-gatherer tribe in Tanzania, Africa, called the Hanzas. And the Hanzas literally hunt with bows and arrows. The men walk 8 to 10 miles every day. The women walk anywhere from 3 to 6 miles every day, gathering berries and digging up tubers. They're thin, they're fit, they really have no diseases. And so these researchers said, gee, I'll bet you if we measure the energy expenditure of this hunter-gatherer group and compare them to the energy expenditure of office workers, desk workers, I'll bet you we're going to be shocked that these Hanzas, you know, the reason they're so skinny and fit is that they're, you know, using up all this energy. Lo and behold, they found that the Hanzas were, you know, walking 10 miles a day, use the same amount of energy as a desk worker who doesn't move.
How do you measure energy?
You can actually look at calories consumed and then put them on a calorimeter and look at respiratory quotient, how much oxygen you burn, how much CO2 you produce. The conclusion was, well, guess what? We all make the exact same amount of energy, no matter how active we are, no matter how inactive we are. And so there. And, you know, I'm a researcher and I go, wait a minute, you know, that doesn't pass the sniff test at all. So what's really going on? Well, in my work, we know that inflammation, and I think most people have heard about inflammation. Inflammation is basically a war that goes on in our body against enemies that come into us. For instance, if you caught the flu, the plain old flu, you would be incredibly tired. You'd be exhausted. You would hurt. Your brain wouldn't work. You certainly wouldn't want to look at your computer. You might want to Netflix some binge show. But you feel awful. Well, that's inflammation. That's us warring against this flu virus. Now, in our case, in the desk workers, what we've found and other people have found is that we have chronic inflammation from leaky gut.
We've discussed this, but I just want to review. I hear the word inflammation everywhere now. Every doctor, every diet, every nutritionist is talking about inflammation. What exactly is that? Your cells in different organs are experiencing an enemy. What's that enemy and what's inflammation?
Okay, so inflammation is produced by our white blood cells, our immune system. And these guys are basically, if you will, foot soldiers. And 80% of all of our white blood cells line our gut, line our intestines. And our intestines are actually the surface area of a tennis court. And everybody looks down and go, wait a minute, there's no tennis court in there. But in fact, there is. And so imagine that 80% of your army is lining the walls of your gut. And things can come through the walls of your gut. That's why they're all down there. Bacteria come through the wall of your gut. Lectins, which are these little nasty plant proteins, actually make leaks, make holes in the wall of your gut. And food particles come across, lectins come across, bacteria come across. So there's actually a constant war going on in our abdomen. That war consumes huge amounts of energy, just like, for instance, your soldiers have got to be fed. And if there's a war, you're going to send the food and supplies to the troops who are fighting the war. And what that means, to use the war analogy, is that other people who are staying behind, like, say, our muscles or our brain, are going to be rationed because all this food and supplies have to go to the army.
So again, just to summarize, we sleep to recoup our energy. We wake up in the morning, supposedly with a full bucket of energy now for the day, but it's like a fixed amount and we get to spend it wisely. If your body is going to spend your energy by just repairing itself all day, if it's inflamed, you'll be weaker in other areas. The same thing, like if they're arguing on Twitter all day, you probably won't have energy for your real job.
That's true.
That's an inflammation of a different sort. Social media inflammation.
Yeah, that's a social media inflammation. But the point is well taken. If you're going to devote all that energy to that social media, you're not going to have the energy to do the other things you want to do or the time. And that's actually what's happening to most of us.
So obviously things like, you know, dessert, I think specifically potato chips, there's like grease, the oils, the fried, it's probably just all inflammation. But how does inflammation, why is it inflammation? Like, how does that work?
Great. Well, it turns out that probably around 60 to 70% of all of the food we eat now isn't whole food anymore. It is processed and ultra processed food. And back in the good old days when we ate whole food, whenever we actually had a whole, let's just use a chicken breast, and a whole sweet potato or some whole broccoli, would actually take us a long time to digest those carbohydrates in the broccoli, the protein in the chicken breast, and the fat, the olive oil that we poured on it, very slowly. And it would actually arrive at our energy-producing organelles called the mitochondria, where we actually make energy from food, slowly. And it would actually come in small bits. And the mitochondria are great at processing either protein, either carbohydrates, or fat. They can do all of that, but they like to do one part at a time. But now, because we've made processed foods, give you an example, let's take your potato chip. So now we have carbohydrates from the potatoes and fat that they've been fried in, and they're instantly digestible. They no longer have to be broken down. And so our mitochondria, much like living in LA, pretty much 24 hours a day have rush hour in the energy production line. And it's this rush hour that literally energy production grinds to a halt. Now, as anyone who lives in the LA area will tell you, rush hour literally happens constantly now. And it may take me an hour to go 2 miles on an LA freeway.
Now, again, is this because because things like sugar and potato chips and all that, it's so broken down and processed on purpose so that it's easy to, quote unquote, easy to digest.
Correct.
Our brain is constantly thinking, hey, this is not normal. We need to eat things that digest
slowly.
We're already finished digesting, but the brain doesn't know that it doesn't digest all day anymore. So it says we need more potato chips now.
That's exactly right. What happens is this literally energy freeway just gets ground to a halt because of all this stuff we're trying to shove into it. And your brain says, hey, I'm not getting any energy. You guys got to, you know, eat some more energy because I'm not getting any. So that makes us hungrier to go get more of the crap. And so 2 o'clock in the afternoon after your big lunch, everything's ground to a halt. Rush hour stopped the traffic. Your brain says, hey, I'm not getting any energy. You need an energy bar. And of course, that energy bar is just, you know, pure carbohydrates and fat. And wham, it just slams right into the backup that's already happening. And so we just never actually get the energy flowing like we should. And that brings up another point, James. So believe it or not, studies in America show that the average American is now consuming food for 16 hours a day. Think about that.
Wait, I don't understand, because you have breakfast for like a half hour. Lunch is like an hour. Dinner is like an hour.
We don't do that anymore. We nibble, snack, we grab things off a counter. There's really good research by Sachin Panda out of the Salk Institute in San Diego that has documented, having people using apps, that the average American eats 16 hours a day.
Okay, so let's say you're eating 16 hours a day, but you also, according to studies, using social media 6 hours a day and watching television 4 hours a day and then sleeping 8 hours a day. But I guess they're combining.
Oh, exactly.
All four of those things.
We don't, most of us don't sit down for breakfast, lunch, and dinner like we used to. We're munching on the go. We're grabbing something. We're eating out of our car on the way, and we're talking into our social media account on the car. So we're constantly nibbling energy-producing foods, but the nibbling of energy-producing foods is actually stopping energy production.
Even if the last thing you eat is a really great source of energy, it has to wait in line while the full bag of potato chips is being digested. Why is junk food so easily digestible? Is it because it's been sliced up for us, or it's been made already?
Yeah, it's been manipulated to be rapidly absorbed, and it's manipulated on purpose. In fact, believe it or not, the first pre-digested food that was ever advertised was advertised 110 years ago. It was a breakfast food. I'd let you guess who actually advertised the first pre-digested meal.
Mr. Kellogg.
Mr. Kellogg. Kellogg's Corn Flakes was advertised as the first pre-digested meal.
That's interesting you call it pre-digested. So
that's what they called it. In other words, all the work was done for you. And so you will instantly absorb it. And that's so horrible for the way your system works.
So if Corn Flakes has 200 calories, but also we haven't defined yet what good foods are, but let's say some really good food has 200 calories. What's the difference? Aren't I getting 200 calories either way? And this is a layup. I know the answer, but I'm letting you answer this.
Perfect. Yeah, so the 200 calories of Kellogg's Corn Flakes, you're going to absorb basically 200 calories of sugar. And that sugar is actually going to literally run right into your mitochondria and slow things down. On the other hand, let's suppose I had you eat 200 calories of a sweet potato. Let's keep it a carbohydrate just for fun. That sweet potato is a complex starch, and that means lots of sugar molecules stuck together, and you have to produce enzymes to break all of these sugar molecules apart, and that takes time. You won't be able to break all those sugar molecules apart by the time that rest of that sweet potato gets down to your lower intestines, where your microbiome lives, your gut buddies, your friendly bacteria. They want a lot of those starches for themselves. These are called prebiotic fibers. So in the process of eating 200 calories of sweet potatoes, you're going to burn some energy doing the digestion, and you're going to lose about 30% of all the calories in that sweet potato to your gut bacteria, who are going to eat them and produce compounds that are called postbiotics that we can talk about in a minute. So that sweet potato, even though it's 200 calories, has nowhere near the calories of that 200 calories of cereal. Plus, you fed friendly bacteria who are going to eat a lot of those calories. Plus, you had to use a lot of energy to do it.
Is that good, using the energy to process it?
Oh, brother. Yeah. One of the things that's been done is give human beings the exact same calorie amount in pre-digested food, modern ultra-processed food, and the same calories in foods that you would have to digest. And even though you both ate 200 calories, for instance, the guy who got the pre-digested food absorbed, number one, far more of those calories directly. And number two, didn't use up any energy in eating those calories. And so the net result in humans was that 200 calories of potato chips and cornflakes is horrible for putting on weight compared to 200 calories of a sweet potato.
I'm trying to understand the process. So basically, when sugar comes in or some junk food or processed food, it's 200 calories, but it's absorbed right away. What happens to that energy? Are we energetic for a short time, or what's happening?
No, so what happens is, so the mitochondria can only process so much energy produced, so many calories at a time. And the mitochondria don't like to get overworked. They don't like to get bombarded with, let's use sugar for an example. They don't like to get bombarded. And so they actually put up resistance to all of this coming into the mitochondria. And people hopefully now have heard of insulin resistance or pre-diabetes. And it's literally mitochondria, as I talk about in the book, set up a wall to try to keep all of the sugar from getting into them and it to come in slowly. And they literally produce chemicals, fats called ceramides. Primarily, we make them from sugary foods. We make them from fruit, believe it or not. We make them from high fructose corn syrup. And that's why somewhere between 60 and 80% of Americans are insulin resistant. Our mitochondria are trying to protect themselves from this constant bombardment of easily digested.
So what happens to the calories? What happens to the energy? What does the mitochondria, it's been bombarded. Does it just like say, hey, we're throwing you out. We're not using you as energy, even though you're calories?
Yeah, we're going to store you as fat. Mm. And quite frankly, the more insulin, so when you and I eat cornflakes, we'll use that example, your pancreas squirts out some insulin, the hormone that literally is a salesperson to all of your cells. And it knocks on the door of, say, your muscles. And they say, oh, you know, this guy just ate some great cornflakes. Look at all this great sugar. And open the door, muscles. I want to sell it to you. And the muscles go, are you kidding? We have moved all day. We don't need anything. We're full. Thanks a lot. Go sell it someplace else. Well, insulin says, geez, I got to get rid of this sugar. I'll get 12 of my friends with a battering ram, and I'll try to shove it into the muscles. And the muscles, you know, no, there's no room in here. So insulin says, I got to get rid of this stuff. I know, I'll turn it into fat. And it turns out that insulin says, you know, this guy will thank me someday, because someday there won't be any cornflakes. There's going to be hard times. There'll be COVID. He doesn't have a job. And he's going to thank me for having all that fat. Well, unfortunately, we now live in basically 365 days of endless summer, endless food. And we just keep taking the food we eat that's arriving too quickly to our mitochondria to process, and we turn it into fat.
Do you feel this is a problem with the medical industry, that basically the solution for diabetes, as an example, I'm just using this as an example, is, hey, let's just give them more insulin, since the body is, the insulin was so busy that it basically failed. Let's just give them more insulin so they can keep eating tiramisu at night or
yeah,
you know, cake.
Well,
instead of saying, hey, just don't eat as much sugar and you won't tax the insulin, and your insulin will regrow. Does the insulin regrow once it's gone, like from diabetes?
I've never met a type 2 diabetic that I couldn't make normal by teaching them how to eat. And this book, The Energy Paradox, really gives a step-by-step way to not only get your energy back, but actually to make insulin levels fall, to make your mitochondria happy again. And you're right, the medical profession, particularly early when I was being trained, that's what we did. We gave people insulin, and that would bring down their blood sugar. But what we didn't know was that insulin was the fat storage hormone. And so the more insulin we gave these people, the fatter they got. And the last thing that they needed was more insulin.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner, or whatever you want to call it, what do you do for energy? You have a lot of energy. I know you do. And I go up and down. I think some days I'm pretty good and some days I'm not. Particularly since the pandemic started, I would say I do a little too many carbs / processed carbs, like go to the bakery and get a pastry.
Yeah.
So what I've been trying to do, given that I know I'm not going to be moving as much, I try to intermittent fast to basically not overload the system. But I probably have been eating a little more junk food than I've normally have this past year.
Well, so the book really tries to teach people how to successfully, you want to call it intermittent fasting, call it time-controlled eating. But the evidence is it's overwhelming that the more we can actually shorten our eating window, the time we start eating in the morning and the time we stop eating in the evening, the more we can slowly shorten that to about 6 to 8 hours, the more, believe it or not, energy our mitochondria are capable of producing. And my folks hate for me to say this, you could actually occasionally get away with eating something that's really pretty not good for you. And these studies have been confirmed in human trials. They've been confirmed in phenomenal mouse trials at the NIH. But let me give you a great example of Italian athletes. So they took two groups of Italian athletes, cyclists. They gave them each the exact same calories per day to eat, the exact same food. Everybody had to eat the same food. They did this for 2 months. One group had to eat all their calories in a 12-hour window. They ate breakfast at 8 o'clock, they ate lunch at 1, they finished dinner by 8 o'clock at night, a 12-hour window. The other group, they started breakfast at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They had lunch at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they had to finish dinner by 8 o'clock. So they were basically a 6 to 7 hour window. What happened to the two groups? They're eating the same food, the same calories. They're exercising exactly the same. The group that compressed their eating window lost weight. The other group didn't, eating the same amount of calories. The group that compressed their eating window kept their muscle mass, and they had this marker of longevity called insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, obtain optimal numbers. So the lower your IGF-1, the longer you're going to live and live well. The other group had none of these effects. So just by compressing their eating window, they were able to achieve that. And that's what you want to do. Now, to say that, believe it or not, 80% of us are what's called metabolically inflexible or insulin resistant. And if I ask 80% of your listeners, tomorrow, I don't want you to eat lunch. I want you to eat your first meal, break fast at noon, and I want you to starve until then. 80% of people would basically fall flat on their face. They'd have no energy. They'd have a headache. They'd have stomach pains. They go, I can't do this. And that's because we haven't been able to make the shift between burning sugar as a fuel and burning fat as a fuel. And that's through the 6-week program in the Energy Paradox. What I do is, all right, let's say Monday morning, you eat breakfast at 7. When we start the program on Monday, you're going to eat breakfast at 8. You can wait an hour. Come on, that's not a big deal. On Tuesday, I want you to eat breakfast at 9. On Wednesday, I want you to eat breakfast at 10. And so on until Friday. And then we take the weekend off. It's free time. You don't have to do anything. The following week, we're going to start breakfast at 9 instead of 8 like we did. And so each week, we're going to go up 1 hour at a time. And by the time 6 weeks are over, we're going to break fast at noon and finish up around 7 o'clock at night. And it'll be effortless to get there.
It makes so much sense to do it in a gradual way. I remember, you know, it's very interesting for me doing this podcast. Like I've had maybe 1,000 guests and everybody's amazing and I've learned so much, but I always notice, I kind of meta notice what I remember from even years, you know, some podcasts I forget afterwards, some I remember. I of course remember our first one very well, but there's one I did in 2014 where I remember the guest said to me that it was hard for him to switch from his really bad diet of Coca-Cola and potato chips and all this to he was becoming a vegan. And he explained to me it's because the food you eat creates, you know, organic bacteria in your gut that becomes hungry for that food. So when you first make, if the switch, if you make it too fast, that gut bacteria is still alive and is going to be very, very upset.
No, that's absolutely true. And I talk about it in all my books, including the energy paradox.
Yes.
That essentially have two sets of bacteria, what I call the gut buddies, the good guys, and the gang members. And the gang members, like you talk about, they want simple sugar and they want fats. And that's what they live on. And we now know that there is a communication system between your gut bacteria and your brain. And these gang members actually send messages to your brain that, hey, buddy, you know, you better get me a croissant and, you know, a tub of lard.
Gut bacteria is yelling that right now.
Yeah, there you go. And you better get it for me. But what's been shown in my clinic and other clinics is that if it takes about 3 days to get the gang members to leave, basically starve them to death, and give the gut buddies what they want. And then the gut buddies, in turn, the good guys, they start sending messages to your brain going, wow, you know, if I need a salad, okay? I really need a salad. I need you to find me a salad. And I'll have these meat and potato guys, you know, in my clinics come in, there, doc, don't worry about it. There's no way I'm ever gonna eat a salad. Just don't waste your time. I see them a month later and they say, I don't know what's happened to me. If I don't get a salad, you know, I'm going to kill somebody. I said, that's not me. Well, it turns out it's their bacteria that have taken over the rules and taken over their brain. And that's actually what's so exciting about this book, that we can measure those compounds that do this. We've always conjectured that there was this text message system that, you know, well, we know it exists, but we can't measure it. And in the book, we talk about postbiotics, which is the language that's been discovered between our gut buddies and our brain and our mitochondria. And the discovery of this language is as exciting as the breaking of the Enigma code in World War II, the German code. I mean, it's that exciting that it actually won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, the discovery of this language between these one-cell little organisms and us and our mitochondria. And they're called postbiotics.
You know, you discuss this, a lot about this in the book, but like, what do you do personally to kind of up the good guys in the postbiotics and suppress the bad guys? Obviously, the food you eat is a lot of that, but just talk about that. Like, what is the food you eat? What do you personally do?
Right. So as far as I know, I'm the first person to write about time-controlled eating, intermittent fasting, back in my first book in 2006.
Diet Revolution?
Yeah. And I actually had a whole chapter on intermittent fasting that my editor said, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard of. This is crazy. No one's going to believe you, and I'll give you 2 pages to make your case, but everybody, you know, that's crazy. I said, no, it's not crazy. I've been doing this. I started doing this in 2000. From January through June every year, I eat one meal a day. I eat all my calories from 6 to 8 o'clock at night. So 22 out of 20, 4 hours during the week, I'm fasting. I'm not eating. So no breakfast, no lunch, and I eat all my calories in 2 hours. And that's called the eat one meal a day, or in the book, EOMAD. Now, I didn't start off doing that. I started off by actually doing exactly what is in the book. It's just gradually increasing the time I start eating. And the cool thing about it is, if you do it gradually, there is no hunger. There's no such thing. I'm not hungry now, and it's, you know, coming on 11 o'clock, you know, my time. And I haven't eaten anything. And I won't eat lunch. Then I'll eat dinner later on today. But you got to get there slowly. It's like going to the gym and starting a new exercise routine. You know, I'm not going to go bench press 400 pounds. If I tried to bench press 400 pounds, you know, I'd cut my neck off. And well, boom.
If someone asked you for a breakfast meeting, what do you do at the breakfast meeting?
Black coffee or tea.
All right. No toast or anything?
Oh, toast. That's poison. Come on. It's pure sugar. Come on.
I know, but I love toast. I always tell people, I don't know how to use my kitchen, but I'm a great toaster. Like, I know how to use the toaster really well.
Believe it or not, strange but true, toasting bread actually slows its absorption rate. And there's actually a true reason why, if you had to eat bread, and I'm not telling you to eat bread, James, toast it. And if you have to eat bread, sourdough instead of any other, and certainly not whole wheat, please.
Really? And what about all these like fancy 7-grain things?
That's even more poisonous. Grains have the highest lectin content of any food. If you want a leaky gut, if you want inflammation, please eat your whole grain bread and, you know, 7-grain bread. Just don't do it.
And speaking of remembering things from podcasts, I very clearly remember the visual image you have of the lectins are, I guess, bigger than other cells that pass in and out of the gut. So they pierce the guts, the insides of your intestines, and that's what causes this leaky gut.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me 15 years ago with my first book what I thought about leaky gut, I would have told you it was pseudoscience. But now, thanks to work by Dr. Visano from Harvard and others in my clinics, we know that almost everyone with low energy, and certainly anyone with a pre-existing condition, like heart disease, like diabetes, like high blood pressure, has leaky gut. Hippocrates, 2,500 years ago, the father of medicine, said all disease begins in the gut. And the guy was right. And you know, he didn't have all our fancy tests. He just knew that everything happens in the gut.
Obviously, I think it's almost common sense what foods, at a very broad level, junk foods, bad. most processed carbs are quote unquote bad. And I don't mean to simplify so much, but I'm just thinking everybody gets so in the woods with these foods are good, these foods are not. Everyone's recommending different things. And even, you know, I would say this confusion arises a little with you when I think, oh my gosh, which plants have lectins? I thought this plant was good, but not this plant. Like, so that it's hard to keep track of everything, but just on a very broad level, salads good, organic stuff good, things that were just pulled out of the ground and cleaned and served to you are probably pretty good.
Yeah, roots are great for you. Tubers are great for you. Have some radishes, have some parsnips, have some sweet potatoes. Any, you know, the cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, they're fantastic for you.
Oh, and I recently read that broccoli was not so good, but it might have been because of it's like a very starchy vegetable. And again, everybody says different things, but you're saying so broccoli good.
Yeah. Again, one of the things that I introduce in this book that I think puts this battle between, oh, you should be eating, you know, basically a carbohydrate-based diet, or you should be eating a carnivore diet where all you eat is meat, or you should be eating an 80% fat diet, a ketogenic diet. And you go, well, wait a minute, you know, you guys all can't be right. You know, which is it? Well, what I've written about in previous books, and I really go into this in this book, is one of the things that is in common with all these various weird diets is, in general, they're telling you you'd eat one sort of food. In other words, mostly carbohydrates, mostly protein, mostly fat. And what I show in the book is if you use what I call a mono diet, your mitochondria have only one food to work with at a time. And they're actually pretty good about doing that. But most of our processed food has sugars, fats, and proteins all clombed into one. And it, again, whacks into our mitochondria. So in the book, the first meal of the day, the break fast, I actually ask people to have a mono meal. In other words, if you want puffed millet cereal with almond milk as your break fast, go for it. If you want Canadian bacon with egg whites, go for it. If you want an avocado cut in half with egg yolks in the middle under a broiler and pour olive oil on it, a pure fat meal, go for it. If you want to change up every day, go for it. And people go, wait a minute. You mean I can have, you know, I can interchange? And I say, yeah, as long as you choose one energy substance, your mitochondria will think you're just the best person in the world.
Although you mentioned earlier that there's different mitochondria for different nutrients, right?
No. The mitochondria have to use the nutrients in a totally different way. So there's a pathway to turn protein into energy. There's a pathway to turn fat into energy. And there's a pathway to turn sugar, glucose, into energy. And there's in the mitochondria, and they're slightly different. Mitochondria have to be able to switch gears. And in our old-time traditional diets, where we all ate whole foods, they had plenty of time to switch gears. And believe it or not, we didn't ever used to eat 16 hours a day. In fact, breakfast is a very modern thing. It actually started in the Industrial Revolution in the late 1900s, where workers would go to a factory and they weren't given lunch breaks. They didn't have any mandatory, you know, oh, you need 15 minutes of break. They had to work all the way through the day. And so it got the tradition of, well, you better have something to eat before you go lock in the factory for the next 14 hours. And so breakfast was actually a brand new meal. The French have no word for breakfast. Déjeuner is their first meal. They had to invent petit déjeuner for the tourists. Mm-hmm. The Hadzas don't eat breakfast. I mean, you really think they, you know, crawl out of their, you know, hut and say, what's for breakfast? There isn't any breakfast. There's no storage system.
And it makes sense because I guess, you know, let's take 40,000 years ago, you could only eat if you found food that day. And
that's right.
So
and
probably
that was
some
breakfast.
Days you found. Yeah. So, that's a very natural, almost organic, to use the word, intermittent fasting.
That's what it was.
You ate when you had food. But for every meal, should it be a mono meal or?
No. So what I like to do, so mono meals get into trouble because in general, they don't have enough fiber to feed the good guys, the probiotics, the gut buddies. And so the gut buddies can't make these postbiotics. And postbiotics are these gases and also short-chain fatty acids like butyrate that actually turbocharge your mitochondria, actually tell them to get up and go, make more energy. And that's one of the failures of so many of these diets, whether it's a carnivore diet, whether it's a keto diet, or whether it's a high carbohydrate diet, is that they don't feed our gut buddies the food they need.
So you need to basically be like a flexitarian, eat a little bit of everything except for the processed stuff.
Yep.
You know, what I don't understand is, and everybody takes the simple answer that, this is the big food industry made the food pyramid. But the food pyramid, if you look at it now, like the original food pyramid, is so bad for you based on what we know now. Like, I think there's like 6 servings of pasta a day recommended in the food pyramid, 5 glasses of milk when most people are lactose intolerant, depending on your ethnicity and so on. What made modern medicine veer so much from health?
Sickness is good for business. Recently had Dr. Kessler, who was the head of the FDA when the last food labeling thing was made. And when he put down, you know, the amount of sugar in a product. He was called into the Oval Office, as he tells it, and there was the Secretary of Agriculture and a number of the big food giants, and they said, we're sorry, you cannot put that on a label. You cannot tell people how much sugar is in this product. And he said, but wait a minute, that's how much sugar is in this product. They said, no, you cannot tell them that. And you're going to have to design that label in a way to hide where the sugar is. And he uses the example of a bagel. And he says, okay, you look at the bagel, it's got 330 calories. And you look at sugars and it says zero sugars. And you go, oh, there's a healthy food for me. I'm watching my sugar. He says, you got to look at total carbohydrates. And there's 33 grams of carbohydrates. And then you look underneath and there's fiber. There's no fiber. He says, so instead of being zero sugar, there's actually 33 grams of sugar. Now, to put that in perspective, there's 4 grams of carbohydrates in a teaspoon of sugar. So you do a little math. So there's over 8 teaspoons of pure sugar in that bagel, and it's not on the label.
Oh, my gosh. So
we've been duped.
So when he said to them, though, so he's in the Oval Office, which is people who care about the U.S. supposedly, and he said to them, listen, this is for everybody. This is for the health of 300 million people. Did they respond?
They basically say how naive you are. I mean, as I wrote about in one of my previous books, simultaneously with Michelle Obama having, you know, a victory garden in the White House and teaching kids how to grow gardens and teaching kids how to eat low fat, simultaneously, the Department of Agriculture was doing deals with Domino's Pizza to pay for $100 million of free advertising if Domino's would double the amount of cheese in their pizzas. And they bragged about it because they were supporting America's dairy farmers. At the same time, Michelle Obama was telling kids to eat their vegetables and please cut back on these sorts of fats. So it's out of one mouth and into another, and that's the dichotomy of modern big food and big government.
This is such a change in, I mean, of course, many people have many changes in career, but you were, you know, doing these heart transplants and you were, you know, you were the best in the area. I mean, you were doing these incredible surgeries and saving lives. And of course, you're doing great things now. What made you, though, switch fully? Like, what's your career like right now? What do you do? What do you do for a living?
So I see patients 6 days a week in my two clinics. And about 78% of my patients have autoimmune diseases that they've been to the best of the best around the country and the world, and they're still there. And knock on wood, we're about 90% successful in reversing any autoimmune disease that walks through the door. And then on Fridays, I'm at Gundry MD, my supplement and food company. And I'm always, you know, coming up with new ideas on food that's going to keep people away from people like me. My nickname is No More Mr. Knife Guy.
Why'd you switch to this from heart surgeries?
I watched a guy over 21 years ago now, 22 years ago, who I call Big Ed in all my books, big, giant, fat, 48-year-old guy from Miami, by the way. And he had inoperable coronary artery disease. Every blood vessel was clogged up. You couldn't put stents in. You couldn't do bypass. And guys like him would go around the country looking for idiots like me who would take him on. And, you know, there were a handful of us, and they'd make a circuit around the country, and I'd often be at the end of the circuit. So Big Ed comes into my office after 6 months of trying to find some idiot to operate on him. And I look at his angiogram, the catheterization of his heart, and I go, you know, I'm not going to help you. Everybody else is right. They're right. I'm not going to do you any good. He says, well, look, you know, I've been on a diet and I've lost 45 pounds in the last 6 months. And I went to a health food store and I've been taking all these supplements. He said, maybe I did something in here. And I'm scratching my professor beard going, well, you know, good for you for losing weight. But that's not going to do anything in here. And I know what you did with all those supplements. You made expensive urine, which is what I really believed back then. And he says, well, come on. Why don't we get a new angiogram, a new catheterization? Let's see. I go, don't get your hopes up. So we do. This guy, in 6 months' time, has cleaned out 50% of the blockages in his heart. Wow. 50%. They're gone.
And that's from switching away from processed foods.
And taking a bunch of cool supplements.
Well, what supplements would you recommend?
So, and I've got a whole list in the book.
Yes.
Number one, everybody's got to take vitamin D3. We now, there are 17 different studies showing the higher your vitamin D level, the more protected you are from COVID. And if you catch COVID, it will be a mild illness.
When's it too much vitamin D? Like, when do you just, as you say, have expensive urine of vitamin D? Like, I take 10,000 IU a day. Is that too much? Is that too little?
No, I take 10,000.
I never go outdoors.
Yeah, I take 10,000 a day. 80% of Southern Californians are vitamin D deficient, even though we got sunshine all the time. The University of California, San Diego, thinks the average American should take 10,000 IUs of vitamin D3 every day. It's one of the best anti-cancer supplements there are. And let's not be confused. Vitamin D is a hormone. It's actually not a vitamin at all. And it's essential for so many things, particularly for leaky gut. I can't begin to tell you how important it is. The other thing that almost everybody should get is fish oil. Now, most fish oil is molecularly distilled now. That means there's no heavy metals. But the important part of fish oil is called DHA. And you want to get about 1,000 milligrams of DHA per day. Your brain is about 70% fat. So if your kids call, Daddy, you're a fathead, you know, I'll back them. And half of the fat in your brain is DHA. And as I showed in the longevity paradox, if you look at people as they age, people who have the highest omega-3 index, which is a way of measuring DHA and EPA in your blood, have the biggest brains and the biggest areas of memory. And people who have the lowest omega-3 index as they age have the most shrunken brains and the smallest areas of memory.
So these are amazing studies. And you would think if somebody heard that study, they would go to the local health food store and just get like a ton of DHA.
Yep,
and yet the studies aren't in the news, or people don't get them, or what's the story?
These stories are bad for business. Mm. Remember, sickness is good for business. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, I was asked to consult with some major manufacturers in a fairly large Midwestern city, and I won't tell you where it is because it would give
Chicago.
It away. Close by Chicago, as a matter of fact. And these guys wanted me to come and institute an eating program, a healthcare program in their businesses. And I go, well, gee whiz, you know, you've got an amazing set of medical centers here in town, and you got a medical school in town. Why don't you go work with them? That would be such an obvious choice. You don't need me. And they said, oh, we did that. And we met with them. And I said, yeah. And they said, are you kidding? Why would we want to teach your employees to be healthy? We're in the sickness business. It may say health center, you know, on the side of the building. You got to understand, we're in the sickness business. And why would we ruin our business? It's true. True story.
I believe it. And it's always disturbing to me, like, how little good information is out there and how hard it is to curate it. I mean, again, I've had like dozens of doctors, nutritionists, and so on the podcast, and a lot of conflicting results, but I'm so grateful when you're on the podcast. A lot of doctors say supplements don't work at all. Like you used to say, like, is there a danger that you just eat it and it doesn't digest properly? And
quite frankly, the longer I've been at this, the more impressed I am with the power of properly chosen supplements to enhance your health. And I go into that in each book, why supplements are important. But we're beginning to realize that particularly supplements that contain what are called polyphenols. And how do you remember that? Polywanaphenol is the way to remember it. Is that
that's really not a helpful way to remember it, but I'll go with it.
Polywanacracker, polywanaphenol.
I understand, yeah, but it's okay.
anyhow, polyphenols, for instance, red wine has polyphenols. Dark chocolate has polyphenols. Coffee has polyphenols. Tea has polyphenols. And in concentrated form, I've published papers looking at people's flexibility in their blood vessels and change the polyphenols, their blood vessels get more flexible. Take the polyphenols away, their blood vessels get stiff. We've looked at people who have sticky blood vessels and we give them polyphenols and their blood vessels get lined with Teflon. We take the polyphenols away from them. Their blood vessels become sticky again like flypaper.
What supplements are the best for polyphenols?
Well, so you can eat your polyphenols, believe it or not. But if you wanted a couple that I've studied in patients, grape seed extract is one of them. And pycnogenol, French maritime tree bark. It used to be patented, but now you can buy it. And we've published data. These two do remarkable things to the lining of your blood vessels. Just an example.
Yeah, I don't take those. I should probably take them. I take zinc chelate. Is that good?
Yeah, but don't take too much. We only need about 30 to 50 milligrams of zinc. Zinc has to be balanced with copper, and you can really kind of screw up that ratio if you take too much zinc.
And I've also heard you shouldn't take too much vitamin C.
Well, vitamin C, unfortunately, is a water-soluble vitamin, and we excrete most of our vitamin C in 2 to 3 hours after we take it. And so if you're going to take vitamin C, and I highly recommend it, you should take timed-release vitamin C and take 1,000 milligrams twice a day, and that'll keep you with a nice low level of vitamin C.
Wow, vitamin C.
We're one of the few animals that don't manufacture our own vitamin C. Us and guinea pigs and monkeys.
Let me ask you an off-the-wall question. I wonder if, given that we've used science to kind of patch up the medical industry for so many decades, I wonder if there's going to be a next generation of that where somebody says, okay, let's take some stem cells, turn it into mitochondria, just quadruple everybody's mitochondria so that they can start processing all the processed foods much better. Could that happen?
You don't need any of that. If you follow my book, you will quadruple your mitochondria virtually in a few weeks. The book is How to Make More Mitochondria. So you don't need stem cells to do that. You just need to tell your current mitochondria to make more of themselves, and the book shows you how to do that.
Well, you know, again, Dr. Gundry, such an excellent book, and it really is a great companion book to the plant paradox, which was what we talked about the last time you came on the podcast. This is the energy paradox. What to do when your get up and go has got up.
And has got up and gone.
Yeah. It's so valuable. We only live one life, and why waste a moment of it? Energy is such an important concept. Of course, it starts with food. It goes into how you live your life emotionally, creatively, and so on. But food is the base of all. You can't start a business if you're sick. Or it'll be harder. You'll need more energy than you have. And how many hours a night do you sleep?
I try to get about 7 hours of sleep and do quite well at it.
All right, that's good. I try to get 12, but we'll see.
I got to get up and see patients. Come on, I got to take my three dogs for a run. So, you know, I'm stuck. Oh, and by the way, get a dog. If you want more energy, get a dog.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Jay, the producer who's listening in, he has a dog. I have a Yorkie, and my kids take care of it. It's very small.
I had a Yorkie, Fanny Fufu. Loved that dog. And she would actually run 10Ks with me. Hilarious. She literally kind of floated off the ground.
They have a lot of energy. Dr. Gundry, thanks again so much for coming on the podcast. Thanks so much for writing this book, The Energy Paradox. It's really critical in this time, this day and age. And I appreciate, once again, you coming on the podcast.
James, thanks a lot. And for your listeners, just remember, fatigue is not your fate.